Hello. This podcast comes to you today from Cleveland, Ohio, sponsored by Scrambling Science. Today's topic is early atomic theory. We're going to start with some of the theories of the ancients. We have Leucippus and his student Democritus. Democritus gets a little more of the credit. He advanced the theory a little bit further. And what he simply said was that if you took a bar of metal, I believe he thought of copper, but it could have been any metal, and you cut it in half, and cut it in half, and cut it in half, and keep going, that eventually you're going to get to one simple particle that can't be cut, and in Greek, that word is atomos, which means indivisible or uncuttable, and so that's how we got the word atom. Now, of course, he didn't really have any proof. It was more of a philosophical argument, and some of the heavy hitters of the time in science, such as Aristotle, didn't agree with that theory, so he didn't get a whole lot of credit. Democritus was a sophist, which was a teacher. They didn't have public schools back then, organized schools, and so people would hire private tutors to do all of the instruction, and Democritus was one of those, and so all of these sophists needed to have their own theories. Well, onward, we go to Jabir ibn Hayyan, who lived about 800 AD in Arabia. He was an alchemist, which was pretty much most of the chemists at that time. Chemistry wasn't a defined science. The alchemists, no matter what part of the world they were in, seemed to have two goals. One was to turn base metals, iron, zinc, things like that, into gold, and the other was to find the elixir of life. Well, none of them were successful, but the alchemists did do some good work, develop new lab techniques and all that. But Jabir, what he did was he worked with acids. He discovered aqua regia, which is perhaps the strongest acid out there. It will even dissolve gold, and no, we will not be making that in school this year. And he possibly was the first to use the distillation process. But either way, his probably most important point was that he introduced experimentation, and that was sort of a new thing in science. Well, then we went through the Dark Ages, and they were called the Dark Ages for a reason. Not a whole lot went on there. Onward to Robert Boyle, a 17th century English chemist, and he really advanced the scientific method in experimentation. He was probably the last of the alchemists and the first of the true chemists. But as far as atomic theory goes, we have to go up about another 100 years past that to John Dalton, an English school teacher. He was working with gases, and gases took on a lot of importance. And the reason that, starting with Boyle, gases were able to be worked with more was the glass working got better. And so now they could have glassware with good stoppers, good seals, no leakage, and that enabled them to work with a whole other state of matter that they couldn't before. Well, anyway, John Dalton, he worked with gases, tried to combine gases, and came up with four postulates. They're in the book. We've taken them before. They're on the PowerPoints that you get. And like I said, he was the first one to have experimental proof, so he's considered the father of modern atomic theory. One thing about Dalton's ideas, though, is while he was not 100% on the mark, especially when it came to one of his postulates that all atoms of an element are absolutely identical. We know that now that that's not true. He did not know about isotopes, and for instance, carbon-14 different from carbon-12, different types of uranium that are fissionable to be used in nuclear reactors. So that wasn't known at the time, and it wasn't going to be for quite a while, because the neutron hadn't been discovered yet. That was to come another 200 plus years after that. And so that was fine. The ball was rolling. And then we came up to J.J. Thomson. J.J. Thomson developed what's called the raisins in a plum pudding model. And he used cathode ray tubes. So cathode ray tubes were a sealed tube with a metal plate on one end hooked up to an electric current, and a green discharge was given off. And well, back then, they would, you know, they didn't have overly sophisticated techniques, so they would just try everything. Just look at it, you know, try to look at its density, all the physical properties they could. Well, since this was in a sealed tube, they were a little bit limited, but they did try to see if it was magnetic. They knew all about magnets by then and polarity. And sure enough, when a magnet was placed next to this tube, they were able to deflect the beam. And they knew about positive and negative, like I said. And so they developed the idea that an atom exhibits negative charges. And of course, if there's negative charges, they were positive charges. And so how Thomson described this was the raisins in a plum pudding model, where the atom was a sphere. Most of it was positively charged, but you had these little negatively charged electrons embedded into that. Now, there was a lot of disagreement with that theory, but it was the first one to incorporate the idea of the electron, so that was certainly an advancement. And that stayed for a while, and the next big experiment to take place was Ernest Rutherford, a New Zealand scientist who trained in England, did his gold foil experiment. The gold foil experiment was really one of the more remarkable, ingenious concepts of science experimentation. First, you have to understand how thin gold foil really is. We've all seen aluminum foil, but gold foil is much, much thinner. Gold has a remarkable ability to be pounded into very thin sheets. I've heard a description one time where if you were to take a big book like your chemistry textbook, perhaps, and instead of the paper it was pounded thin into gold sheets, that your book would be about as thick as an ordinary sheet of regular paper. That's how thin gold can get, which sort of makes sense because you see gold sometimes on the edges of book as a decorative way to make the book look better, or gold-plated jewelry. You know, if that was solid gold, it would be much, much more expensive. So gold can be pounded very thin. Well, he took a thin sheet of gold foil, and he had an alpha gun. And an alpha gun isn't nearly as high-tech as it sounds. It was simply a block of lead with a hole drilled into it and a tiny, tiny piece of radioactive material, radium, I believe, that emits alpha particles, was inserted into it, and it shot it off in exactly one direction. Well, he had it aimed at a photographic plate, and he could see the sparks when the alpha particles would hit the plate. Well, when he put the gold foil in there, it was a barrier. You could not see through gold foil, as thin as it is. It would be like holding up a big sheet of aluminum foil in front of your eyes. You can't see through it. But yet those particles passed through just like it wasn't there. And so that was amazing. But then, every once in a while, every one in several thousand, it would bounce back. And you'd see different types of deflection. Sometimes the deflection was very, very subtle. Sometimes not so much. It was quite pronounced. Well, what Rutherford deduced from this was that the atom was made out of a central heavy mass, which we now call the nucleus, and these negative bodies were floating around it. And while it wasn't 100%, later on we'll learn about the electron cloud, but it was the start of an atom, a model of an atom that very much resembled what we have now. And so that's where we leave off with the early atomic theory and how it advanced. And if you have further questions, don't hesitate to ask either in class or email. And I hope this helped with your understanding of early atomic theory. And good luck in your studies, and I hope this helped.